thinking that the same cause has brought about the same results in both hemispheres, and that in the midst of the apparent diversity of human affairs, a certain number of primary facts may be discovered, from which all the others are derived. In what we usually call the German institutions, then, I am inclined only to perceive barbarian habits, and the opinions of savages in what we style feudal principles. However strongly the vices and prejudices of the North American Indians may be opposed to their becoming agricultural and civilized, necessity sometimes obliges them to it. Several of the southern nations, and amongst others the Cherokees and the Creeks, were surrounded by Europeans who had landed on the shore of the Atlantic, and who, either descending the Ohio or proceeding up the Mississippi, arrived simultaneously upon their borders. Author's note: these nations are now swallowed up in the states of Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. There were formerly in the South four great nations, remnants of which still exist: the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, the Creeks, and the Cherokees. The remnants of these four nations amounted in 1830 to about 75,000 individuals. It is computed that there are now remaining in the territory occupied or claimed by the Anglo-American Union about 300,000 Indians. The official documents supplied to Congress make the number amount to 313,130. The listener who is curious to know the names and numerical strength of all the tribes which inhabit the Anglo-American territory should consult the documents I refer to. These tribes have not been driven from place to place like their northern brethren, but they have been gradually enclosed within narrowed limits, like the game within the thicket, before the huntsmen plunge into the interior. The Indians who were thus placed between civilization and death found themselves obliged to live by ignominious labor like the whites. They took to agriculture and, without entirely forsaking their old habits or manners, sacrificed only as much as was necessary to their existence. The Cherokees went further. They created a written language, established a permanent form of government, and as everything proceeds rapidly in the New World, before they had all of them clothes, they set up a newspaper. Author's note: I brought back with me to France one or two copies of this singular publication. The growth of European habits has been remarkably accelerated among these Indians by the mixed race which has sprung up. Author's note: see in the report on the Committee on Indian Affairs, 21st Congress, the reasons for the multiplication of Indians of mixed blood among the Cherokees. The principal cause dates from the War of Independence. Many Anglo-Americans of Georgia, having taken the side of England, were obliged to retreat among the Indians, where they married. Deriving intelligence from their father's side, without entirely losing the savage customs of the mother, the half-blood forms the natural link between civilization and barbarism. Wherever this race has multiplied, the savage state has become modified, and a great change has taken place in the manners of the people. Author's note: unhappily, the mixed race has been less numerous and less influential in North America than in any other country. The American continent was peopled by two great nations of Europe, the French and the English. The former were not slow in connecting themselves with the daughters of the natives, but there was an unfortunate affinity between the Indian character and their own. Instead of giving the tastes and habits of civilized life to the savages, the French too often grew passionately fond of the state of wild freedom they found them in. They became the most dangerous of the inhabitants of the desert, and won the friendship of the Indian by exaggerating his vices and his virtues. Monsieur de Senonville, the governor of Canada, wrote thus to Louis XIV in 1685, "It has long been believed that in order to civilize the savages we ought to draw them nearer to us, but there is every reason to suppose we have been mistaken. Those which have been brought into contact with us have not become French, and the French who have lived among them are changed into savages, affecting to dress and live like them. The Englishmen, on the contrary, continuing obstinately attached to the customs and the most insignificant habits of his forefathers, has remained in the midst of the American solitudes just what he was in the bosom of European cities. He would not allow of any communication with savages whom he despised, and avoided with care the union of his race with theirs. Thus, while the French exercised no salutary influence over the Indians, the English have always remained alien from them. The success of the Cherokees proves that the Indians are capable of civilization, but it does not prove that they will succeed in it. This difficulty which the Indians find in submitting to civilization proceeds from the influence of a general cause, which it is almost impossible for them to escape. An attentive survey of history demonstrates that, in general, barbarous nations have raised themselves to civilization by degrees and by their own efforts. Whenever they derived knowledge from a foreign people, they stood towards it in the relation of conquerors, and not of a conquered nation. When the conquered nation is enlightened, and the conquerors are half savage, as in the case of the invasion of Rome by the northern nations, or that of China by the Mongols, the power which victory bestows upon the barbarian is sufficient to keep up his importance among civilized men, and permit him to rank as their equal, until he becomes their rival. The one has might on his side, the other has intelligence. The former admires the knowledge and the arts of the conquered, the latter envies the power of the conquerors. The barbarians at length admit civilized man into their palaces, and he in turn opens his schools to the barbarians. But when the side on which the physical force lies also possesses an intellectual preponderance, the conquered party seldom becomes civilized. It retreats or is destroyed. It may therefore be said, in a general way, that savages go forth in arms to seek knowledge, but that they do not receive it when it comes to them. If the Indian tribes, which now inhabit the heart of the continent, could summon up energy enough to attempt to civilize themselves, they might possibly succeed. Superior already to the barbarous nations which surround them, they would gradually gain strength and experience, and when the Europeans should appear upon their borders, they would be in a state, if not to maintain their independence, at least to assert their right to the soil, and to incorporate themselves with the conquerors. But it is the misfortune of Indians to be brought into contact with the civilized people, which is also, it must be owned, the most avaricious nation on the globe, whilst they are still semi-barbarian, to find despots in their instructors and to receive knowledge from the hand of oppression. Living in the freedom of the woods, the North American Indian was destitute, but he had no feeling of inferiority towards anyone. As soon, however, as he desires to penetrate into the social scale of the whites, he takes the lowest rank in society, for he enters, ignorant and poor, within the pale of science and wealth. After having led a life of agitation, beset with evils and dangers, but at the same time filled with proud emotions, he is obliged to submit to a wearisome, obscure, and degraded state, and to gain the bread which nourishes him by hard and ignoble labor. Such are, in his eyes, the only results of which civilization can boast, and even this much he is not sure to obtain. Author's note: there is in the adventurous life of the hunter a certain irresistible charm, which seizes the heart of man and carries him away in spite of reason and experience. This is plainly shown by the memoirs of Tanner. Tanner is a European who was carried away at the age of 6 by the Indians, and has remained 30 years with them in the woods. Nothing can be conceived more appalling than the miseries which he describes. He tells us of tribes without a chief, families without a nation to call their own, men in a state of isolation, wrecks of powerful tribes wandering at random amid the ice and snow and desolate solitudes of Canada. Hunger and cold pursue them. Every day their life is in jeopardy. Amongst these men, manners have lost their empire. Traditions are without power. They become more and more savage. Tanner shared in all these miseries. He was aware of his European origin. He was not kept away from the whites by force. On the contrary, he came every year to trade with them, entered their dwellings, and witnessed their enjoyments. He knew that whenever he chose to return to civilized life, he was perfectly able to do so, and he remained 30 years in the deserts. When he came into civilized society, he declared that the rude existence which he described had a secret charm for him which he was unable to define, He returned to it again and again. At length he abandoned it with poignant regret. And when he was at length fixed among the whites, several of his children refused to share his tranquil and easy situation. I saw Tanner myself at the lower end of Lake Superior. He seemed to me to be more like a savage than a civilized being. His book is written without either taste or order. But he gives, even unconsciously, a lively picture of the prejudices, the passions, the vices, and, above all, the destitution of which he lived. When the Indians undertake to imitate their European neighbors and to till the earth like the settlers, they are immediately exposed to a very formidable competition. The white man is skilled in the craft of agriculture. The Indian is a rough beginner in an art with which he is unacquainted. The former reaps abundant crops without difficulty. The latter meets with 1,000 obstacles in raising the fruits of the earth. The European is placed amongst a population whose wants he knows and partakes. The savage is isolated in the midst of a hostile people, with whose manners, language, and laws he is imperfectly acquainted, but without whose assistance he cannot live. He can only procure the materials of comfort by bartering his commodities against the goods of the European, for the assistance of his countrymen is wholly insufficient to supply his wants. When the Indian wishes to sell the produce of his labor, he cannot always meet with the purchaser, whilst the European readily finds a market. And the former can only produce at a considerable cost that which the latter vends at a very low rate. Thus the Indian has no sooner escaped those evils to which barbarous nations are exposed than he is subjected to the still greater miseries of civilized communities. And he finds it scarcely less difficult to live in the midst of our abundance than in the depth of his own wilderness. He has not yet lost the habits of his erratic life. The traditions of his fathers and the passion for the chase are still alive within him. The wild enjoyments which formerly animated him in the woods painfully excite his troubled imagination, and his former privations appear to be less keen, his former perils less appalling. He contrasts the independence which he possessed amongst his equals with the servile position which he occupies in civilized society. On the other hand, the solitudes which were so long his free home are still at hand. A few hours' march will bring him back to them once more. The whites offer him a sum, which seems to him to be considerable, for the ground which he has begun to clear. This money of the Europeans may possibly furnish him with the means of a happy and peaceful subsistence in remoter regions. And he quits the plow, resumes his native arms, and returns to the wilderness forever. The condition of the Creeks and Cherokees, to which I have already alluded, sufficiently corroborates the truth of this deplorable picture. Author's note: the destructive influence of highly civilized nations upon others which are less so has been exemplified by the Europeans themselves. About a century ago, the French founded the town of Vincennes up on the Wabash, in the middle of the desert, and they lived there in great plenty until the arrival of the American settlers, who first ruined the previous inhabitants by their competition, and afterwards purchased their lands at a very low rate. At the time when Monsieur de Volney, from whom I borrow these details, passed through Vincennes, the number of the French was reduced to 100 individuals, most of whom were about to pass over to Louisiana or to Canada. These French settlers were worthy people, but idle and uninstructed. They had contracted many of the habits of savages. The Americans, who were perhaps their inferiors in a moral point of view, were immeasurably superior to them in intelligence. They were industrious, well-informed, rich, and accustomed to govern their own community. I saw myself in Canada, where the intellectual difference between the two races is less striking. That the English are the masters of commerce and manufacture in the Canadian country, that they spread on all sides and confine the French within limits which scarcely suffice to contain them. In like manner, in Louisiana, almost all activity in commerce and manufacture centers in the hands of the Anglo-Americans. But the case of Texas is still more striking. The state of Texas is a part of Mexico, and lies upon the frontier between that country and the United States. In the course of the last few years, the Anglo-Americans have penetrated into this province, which is still thinly peopled. They purchase land, they produce the commodities of the country, and supplant the original population. It may easily be foreseen that if Mexico takes no steps to check this change, the province of Texas will very shortly cease to belong to that government. If the different degrees, comparatively so slight, which exist in European civilization, produce results of such magnitude, the consequences which must ensue from the collision of the most perfect European civilization with Indian savages may readily be conceived. The Indians, in the little which they have done, have unquestionably displayed as much natural genius as the peoples of Europe in their most important designs. But nations, as well as men, require time to learn, whatever may be their intelligence and their zeal. Whilst the savages were engaged in the work of civilization, the Europeans continued to surround them on every side and to confine them within narrower limits. The two races gradually met, and they are now in immediate juxtaposition to each other. The Indian is already superior to his barbarous parent, but he is still very far below his white neighbor. With their resources and acquired knowledge, the Europeans soon appropriated to themselves most of the advantages which the natives might have derived from the possession of the soil. They have settled in the country. They have purchased land at a very low rate or have occupied it by force, and the Indians have been ruined by a competition which they had not the means of resisting. They were isolated in their own country, and their race only constituted a colony of troublesome aliens in the midst of a numerous and domineering people. Author's note. See in the legislative documents, 21st Congress, instances of excesses of every kind committed by the whites upon the territory of the Indians, either in taking possession of a part of their lands until compelled to retire by the troops of Congress, or carrying off their cattle, burning their houses, cutting down their corn, and doing violence to their persons. It appears, nevertheless, from all these documents that the claims of the natives are constantly protected by the government from the abuse of force. The Union has a representative agent continually employed to reside among the Indians, and the report of the Cherokee agent, which is among the documents I have referred to, is almost always favorable to the Indians. The intrusion of whites, he says, upon the lands of the Cherokees would cause ruin to the poor, helpless, and inoffensive inhabitants. And he further remarks upon the attempt of the state of Georgia to establish a division line for the purpose of limiting the boundaries of the Cherokees, that the line drawn, having been made by the whites, and entirely upon ex parte evidence of their several rights, was of no validity whatever. Washington said in one of his messages to Congress, "We are more enlightened and more powerful than the Indian nations. We are therefore bound in honor to treat them with kindness and even with generosity." But this virtuous and high-minded policy has not been followed. The rapacity of the settlers is usually backed by the tyranny of the government. Although the Cherokees and the Creeks are established upon the territory which they inhabited before the settlement of the Europeans, and although the Americans have frequently treated with them as with foreign nations, the surrounding states have not consented to acknowledge them as independent peoples, and attempts have been made to subject these children of the woods to Anglo-American magistrates, laws, and customs. Destitution had driven these unfortunate Indians to civilization, and oppression now drives them back to their former condition. Many of them abandoned the soil which they had begun to clear and returned to their savage course of life. Author's note. In 1829, the state of Alabama divided the Creek territory into counties and subjected the Indian population to the power of European magistrates. In 1830, the state of Mississippi assimilated the Choctaws and Chickasaws to the white population and declared that any of them that should take the title of chief would be punished by a fine of $1,000 and a year's imprisonment. When these laws were enforced upon the Choctaws who inhabited that district, the tribe assembled. Their chief communicated to them the intentions of the whites and read to them some of the laws to which it was intended that they should submit, and they unanimously declared that it was better at once to retreat again into the wilds. If we consider the tyrannical measures which have been adopted by the legislatures of the southern states, the conduct of their governors, and the decrees of their courts of justice, we shall be convinced that the entire expulsion of the Indians is the final result to which the efforts of their policy are directed. The Americans of that part of the Union look with jealousy upon the Aborigines. They are aware that these tribes have not yet lost the traditions of savage life, and before civilization has permanently fixed them to the soil, it is intended to force them to recede by reducing them to despair. Author's note: the Georgians, who are so much annoyed by the proximity of the Indians, inhabit a territory which does not at present contain more than 7 inhabitants to the square mile. In France, there are 162 inhabitants to the same extent of country. The Creeks and Cherokees, oppressed by the several states, have appealed to the central government, which is by no means insensible to their misfortunes, and is sincerely desirous of saving the remnant of the natives, and of maintaining them in the free possession of that territory which the Union is pledged to respect. Author's note: in 1818, Congress appointed commissioners to visit the Arkansas Territory, accompanied by a deputation of Creeks, Choctaws, and Chickasaws. This expedition was commanded by Messrs. Kennerly, McCoy, Wash Hood, and John Bell. But the several states oppose so formidable a resistance to the execution of this design that the government is obliged to consent to the extirpation of a few barbarous tribes in order not to endanger the safety of the American Union. But the federal government, which is not able to protect the Indians, would fain mitigate the hardships of their lot, and with this intention, proposals have been made to transport them into more remote regions at the public cost. Between the 33rd and 37th degrees of north latitude, a vast tract of country lies, which has taken the name of Arkansas, from the principal river that waters its extent. It is bounded on the one side by the confines of Mexico, on the other by the Mississippi. Numberless streams cross it in every direction. The climate is mild and the soil productive, but it is only inhabited by a few wandering hordes of savages. The government of the Union wishes to transport the broken remnants of the indigenous population of the South to the portion of this country which is nearest to Mexico, and at a great distance from the American settlements. We were assured, towards the end of the year 1831, that 10,000 Indians had already gone down to the shores of the Arkansas, and fresh detachments were constantly following them. But Congress has been unable to excite a unanimous determination in those whom it is disposed to protect. Some indeed are willing to quit the seat of oppression, but the most enlightened members of the community refuse to abandon their recent dwellings and their springing crops. They are of opinion that the work of civilization, once interrupted, will never be resumed. They fear that those domestic habits which have been so recently contracted may be irrevocably lost in the midst of a country which is still barbarous, and where nothing is prepared for the subsistence of an agricultural people. They know that their entrance into those wilds will be opposed by inimical hordes, and that they have lost the energy of barbarians, without acquiring the resources of civilization to resist their attacks. Moreover, the Indians readily discovered that the settlement which is proposed to them is merely a temporary expedient. Who can assure them that they will at length be allowed to dwell in peace in their new retreat? The United States pledge themselves to the observance of the obligation, but the territory which they at present occupy was formerly secured to them by the most solemn oaths of Anglo-American faith. Author's note: the 5th article of the treaty made with the Creeks in August 1790 is in the following words: "The United States solemnly guarantee to the Creek Nation all their land within the limits of the United States." The 7th article of the treaty concluded in 1791 with the Cherokees says: "The United States solemnly guarantee to the Cherokee Nation all their lands not hereby ceded." The following article declared that if any citizen of the United States or other settler not of the Indian race should establish himself upon the territory of the Cherokees, the United States would withdraw their protection from that individual and give him up to be punished as the Cherokee Nation should think fit. The American government does not indeed rob them of their lands, but it allows perpetual incursions to be made on them. In a few years, the same white population which now flocks around them will track them to the solitudes of the Arkansas. They will then be exposed to the same evils without the same remedies, and as the limits of the earth will at last fail them, their only refuge is the grave. The Union treats the Indians with less cupidity and rigor than the policy of the several states, but the two governments are alike destitute of good faith. The states extend what they are pleased to term the benefits of their laws to the Indians, with the belief that the tribes will recede rather than submit. And the central government, which promises a permanent refuge to these unhappy beings, is well aware of its inability to secure it to them. Authors note, this does not prevent them from promising in the most solemn manner to do so. See the letter of the President addressed to the Creek Indians, March 23, 1829. Beyond the great river Mississippi, where a part of your nation has gone, your father has provided a country large enough for all of you, and he advises you to remove to it. There your white brothers will not trouble you. They will have no claim to the land, and you can live upon it, you and all your children, as long as the grass grows or the water runs, in peace and plenty. It will be yours forever. The Secretary of War, in a letter written to the Cherokees, April 18, 1829, declares to them that they cannot expect to retain possession of the lands at that time occupied by them, but gives them the most positive assurance of uninterrupted peace if they would remove beyond the Mississippi. As if the power which could not grant them protection then would be able to afford it them hereafter. Thus, the tyranny of the states obliges the savages to retire. The Union, by its promises and resources, facilitates their retreat, and these measures tend to precisely the same end. By the will of our Father in heaven, the governor of the whole world, said the Cherokees in their petition to Congress, December 18, 1829, the red man of America has become small, and the white man great and renowned. When the ancestors of the people of these United States first came to the shores of America, they found the red man strong. Though he was ignorant and savage, yet he received them kindly and gave them dry land to rest their weary feet. They met in peace and shook hands in token of friendship. Whatever the white man wanted and asked of the Indian, the latter willingly gave. At that time the Indian was the lord and the white man the suppliant. But now the scene has changed. The strength of the red man has become weakness. As his neighbors increased in numbers, his power became less and less. And now, of the many and powerful tribes who once covered these United States, only a few are to be seen, a few whom a sweeping pestilence has left. The northern tribes, who were once so numerous and powerful, are now nearly extinct. Thus it has happened to the red man of America. Shall we, who are remnants, share the same fate? The land on which we stand, we have received as an inheritance from our fathers, who possessed it from time immemorial, as a gift from our common Father in heaven. They bequeathed it to us as their children, and we have sacredly kept it, as containing the remains of our beloved men. This right of inheritance we have never ceded nor ever forfeited. Permit us to ask, what better right can the people have to a country than the right of inheritance, an immemorial peaceable possession? We know it is said of late by the state of Georgia and by the executive of the United States that we have forfeited this right, but we think this is said gratuitously. At what time have we made the forfeit? What great crime have we committed whereby we must forever be divested of our country and rights? Was it when we were hostile to the United States and took part with the King of Great Britain during the struggle for independence? If so, why was not this forfeiture declared in the first treaty of peace between the United States and our beloved men? Why was not such an article as the following inserted in the treaty? The United States give peace to the Cherokees, but for the part they took in the late war, declare them to be but tenants at will, to be removed when the convenience of the states within whose chartered limits they live shall require it. That was the proper time to assume such a possession, but it was not thought of, nor would our forefathers have agreed to any treaty whose tendency was to deprive them of their rights and their country. Such is the language of the Indians. Their assertions are true. their forebodings inevitable. From whichever side we considered the destinies of the Aborigines of North America, their calamities appear to be irremediable. If they continue barbarous, they are forced to retire. If they attempt to civilize their manners, the contact of a more civilized community subjects them to oppression and destitution. They perish if they continue to wander from waste to waste, and if they attempt to settle, they still must perish. The assistance of Europeans is necessary to instruct them, but the approach of Europeans corrupts and repels them into savage life. They refuse to change their habits as long as their solitudes are their own, and it is too late to change them when they are constrained to submit. The Spaniards pursued the Indians with bloodhounds, like wild beasts. They sacked the New World with no more temper or compassion than a city taken by storm. But destruction must cease, and frenzy be stayed. The remnant of the Indian population which had escaped the massacre mixed with its conquerors, and adopted, in the end, their religion and their manners. Author's note. The honor of this result, however, by no means due to the Spaniards. If the Indian tribes had not been tillers of the ground at the time of the arrival of the Europeans, they would unquestionably have been destroyed in South as well as in North America. The conduct of the Americans of the United States towards the Aborigines is characterized, on the other hand, by a singular attachment to the formalities of law. Provided that the Indians retain their barbarous condition, the Americans take no part in their affairs. They treat them as independent nations and do not possess themselves of their hunting grounds without a treaty of purchase. And if an Indian nation happens to be so encroached upon as to be unable to subsist upon its territory, they afford it brotherly assistance in transporting it to a grave sufficiently remote from the land of its fathers. The Spaniards were unable to exterminate the Indian race by those unparalleled atrocities which brand them with indelible shame, nor did they even succeed in wholly depriving it of its rights. But the Americans of the United States have accomplished this twofold purpose with singular felicity. Tranquilly, legally, philanthropically, without shedding blood, and without violating a single great principle of morality in the eyes of the world, it is impossible to destroy men with more respect for the laws of humanity. Author's note. See, amongst other documents, the report made by Mr. Bell in the name of the Committee on Indian Affairs, February 24, 1830, in which is most logically established and most learnedly proved that the fundamental principle that the Indians had no right by virtue of their ancient possession, either of will or sovereignty, has never been abandoned, either expressly or by implication. In perusing this report, which is evidently drawn up by an experienced hand, one is astonished at the facility with which the author gets rid of all arguments founded upon reason and natural right, which he designates as abstract and theoretical principles. The more I contemplate the difference between civilized and uncivilized man with regard to the principles of justice, the more I observe that the former contests the justice of those rights which the latter simply violates. Situation of the black population in the United States and dangers with which its presence threatens the whites. The Indians will perish in the same isolated condition in which they have lived, but the destiny of the Negroes is in some measure interwoven with that of the Europeans. These two races are attached to each other without intermingling, and they are alike unable entirely to separate or to combine. The most formidable of all the ills which threaten the future existence of the Union arises from the presence of a black population upon its territory. And in contemplating the cause of the present embarrassments or of the future dangers of the United States, the observer is invariably led to consider this as a primary fact. The permanent evils to which mankind is subjected are usually produced by the vehement or the increasing efforts of men. But there is one calamity which penetrated furtively into the world and which was at first scarcely distinguishable amidst the ordinary abuses of power. It originated with an individual whose name history has not preserved. It is wafted like some accursed germ upon a portion of the soil, but it afterwards nurtured itself, grew without effort, and spreads naturally with the society to which it belongs. I need scarcely add that this calamity is slavery. Christianity suppressed slavery, but the Christians of the 16th century reestablished it, as an exception indeed to their social system, and restricted to one of the races of mankind. But the wound thus inflicted upon humanity, though less extensive, was at the same time rendered far more difficult of cure. It is important to make an accurate distinction between slavery itself and its consequences. The immediate evils which are produced by slavery were very nearly the same in antiquity as they are amongst the moderns. But the consequences of these evils were different. The slave, amongst the ancients, belonged to the same race as his master, and he was often the superior of the two in education and instruction. Author's note: it is well known that several of the most distinguished authors of antiquity, and amongst them Aesop and Terence, were or had been slaves. Slaves were not always taken from barbarous nations, and the chances of war reduced highly civilized men to servitude. Freedom was the only distinction between them, and when freedom was conferred, they were easily confounded together. The ancients, then, had a very simple means of avoiding slavery and its evil consequences, which was that of affranchisement. And they succeeded as soon as they adopted this measure generally. Not but in ancient states, the vestiges of servitude subsisted for some time after servitude itself was abolished. There is a natural prejudice which prompts men to despise whomsoever has been their inferior long after he has become their equal. And the real inequality which is produced by fortune or by law is always succeeded by an imaginary inequality which is implanted in the manners of the people. Nevertheless, this secondary consequence of slavery was limited to a certain term amongst the ancients, for the freedman bore so entire a resemblance to those born free that it soon became impossible to distinguish him from amongst them. The greatest difficulty in antiquity was that of altering the law. Amongst the moderns, it is that of altering the manners. And, as far as we are concerned, the real obstacles begin where those of the ancients left off. This arises from the circumstance that, amongst the moderns, the abstract and transient fact of slavery is fatally united to the physical and permanent fact of color. The tradition of slavery dishonors the race, and the peculiarity of the race perpetuates the tradition of slavery. No African has ever voluntarily emigrated to the shores of the New World, whence it must be inferred that all the blacks who are now to be found in that hemisphere are either slaves or freedmen. Thus the Negro transmits the eternal mark of his ignominy to all his descendants. And although the law may abolish slavery, God alone can obliterate the traces of its existence. The modern slave differs from his master not only in his condition, but in his origin. You may set the Negro free, but you cannot make him otherwise than an alien to the European. Nor is this all. We scarcely acknowledge the common features of mankind in this child of debasement whom slavery has brought amongst us. His physiognomy is to our eyes hideous, his understanding weak, his tastes low, and we are almost inclined to look upon him as a being intermediate between man and the brutes. Author's note: to induce the whites to abandon the opinion that they have conceived of the moral and intellectual inferiority of their former slaves, the Negroes must change. But as long as this opinion subsists, to change is impossible. The moderns, then, after they have abolished slavery, have three prejudices to contend against, which are less easy to attack and far less easy to conquer than the mere fact of servitude: the prejudice of the master, the prejudice of the race, and the prejudice of color. It is difficult for us, who have had the good fortune to be born amongst men like ourselves by nature, and equal to ourselves by law, to conceive the irreconcilable differences which separate the Negro from the European in America. But we may derive some faint notion of them from analogy. France was formerly a country in which numerous distinctions of rank existed that had been created by the legislation. Nothing can be more fictitious than a purely legal inferiority, nothing more contrary to the instinct of mankind and these permanent divisions which had been established between beings evidently similar. Nevertheless, these divisions subsisted for ages. They still subsist in many places, and on all sides they have left imaginary vestiges, which time alone can efface. If it be so difficult to root out an inequality which solely originates in the law, how are those distinctions to be destroyed which seem to be based upon the immutable laws of nature herself? When I remember the extreme difficulty with which aristocratic bodies, of whatever nature they may be, are commingled with the mass of the people, and the exceeding care which they take to preserve the ideal boundaries of their caste inviolate, I despair of seeing an aristocracy disappear which is founded upon visible and indelible signs. Those who hope that the Europeans will ever mix with the Negroes appear to me to delude themselves, and I am not led to any such conclusion by my own reason or by the evidence of facts. Hitherto, wherever the whites have been the most powerful, they have maintained the blacks in a subordinate or a servile position. Wherever the Negroes have been strongest, they have destroyed the whites. Such has been the only retribution which has ever taken place between the two races. I see that in a certain portion of the territory of the United States at the present day, the legal barrier which separated the two races is tending to fall away, but not that which exists in the manners of the country. Slavery recedes, but the prejudice to which it has given birth remains stationary. Whosoever has inhabited the United States must have perceived that in those parts of the Union in which the Negroes are no longer slaves, they have in no wise drawn nearer to the whites. On the contrary, the prejudice of the race appears to be stronger in the states which have abolished slavery than in those where it still exists. And nowhere is it so intolerant as in those states where servitude has never been known. It is true that in the north of the Union, marriages may be legally contracted between Negroes and whites. But public opinion would stigmatize a man who should connect himself with a Negress as infamous, and it would be difficult to meet with a single instance of such a union. The electoral franchise has been conferred upon the Negroes in almost all the states in which slavery has been abolished. But if they come forward to vote, their lives are in danger. If oppressed, they may bring an action at law, but they will find none but whites amongst their judges. And although they may legally serve as jurors, prejudice repulses them from that office. The same schools do not receive the child of the black and of the European. In the theaters, gold cannot procure a seat for the servile race beside their former masters. In the hospitals, they lie apart. And although they are allowed to invoke the same divinity as the whites, it must be at a different altar, and in their own churches, with their own clergy. The gates of heaven are not closed against these unhappy beings, but their inferiority is continued to the very confines of the other world. When the Negro is defunct, his bones are cast aside, and the distinction of condition prevails even in the equality of death. The Negro is free, but he can share neither the rights nor the pleasures, nor the labor, nor the afflictions, nor the tomb of him whose equal he has been declared to be. And he cannot meet him upon fair terms in life or in death. In the South, where slavery still exists, the Negroes are less carefully kept apart. They sometimes share the labor and the recreations of the whites. The whites consent to intermix with them to a certain extent, and although the legislation treats them more harshly, the habits of the people are more tolerant and compassionate. In the South, the master is not afraid to raise his slave to his own standing, because he knows that he can in a moment reduce him to the dust at pleasure. In the North, the white no longer distinctly perceives the barrier which separates him from the degraded race, and he shuns the Negro with more pertinacity, since he fears lest they should someday be confounded together. Amongst the Americans of the South, nature sometimes reasserts her rights and restores a transient equality between the blacks and the whites. But in the North, pride restrains the most imperious of human passions. The American of the northern states would perhaps allow the Negress to share his licentious pleasures, if the laws of his country did not declare that she may aspire to be the legitimate partner of his bed, but he recoils with horror from her who might become his wife. Thus it is, in the United States, that the prejudice which repels the Negroes seems to increase in proportion as they are emancipated, and inequality is sanctioned by the manners, whilst it is effaced from the laws of the country. But if the relative position of the two races which inhabit the United States is such as I have described, it may be asked why the Americans have abolished slavery in the north of the Union, why they maintain it in the south, and why they aggravate its hardships there. The answer is easily given. It is not for the good of the Negroes, but for that of the whites, that measures are taken to abolish slavery in the United States. The first Negroes were imported into Virginia about the year 1621. In America, therefore, as well as in the rest of the globe, slavery originated in the South. Thence it spread from one settlement to another, but the number of slaves diminished towards the northern states, and the Negro population was always very limited in New England. Author's note: the number of slaves was less considerable in the North, but the advantages resulting from slavery were not more contested there than in the South. In 1740, the legislature of the state of New York declared that the direct importation of slaves ought to be encouraged as much as possible, and smuggling severely punished in order not to discourage the fair trader. Curious researches by Belknap upon slavery in New England are to be found in the Historical Collection of Massachusetts. It appears that Negroes were introduced there in 1630, but that the legislation and manners of the people were opposed to slavery from the first. See also, in the same work, the manner in which public opinion, and afterwards the laws, finally put an end to slavery. A century had scarcely elapsed since the foundation of the colonies, when the attention of the planters was struck by the extraordinary fact that the provinces, which were comparatively destitute of slaves, increased in population, in wealth, and in prosperity more rapidly than those which contained the greatest number of Negroes. In the former, however, the inhabitants were obliged to cultivate the soil themselves, or by hired laborers. In the latter, they were furnished with hands for which they paid no wages. Yet although labor and expenses were on the one side, and ease with economy on the other, the former were in possession of the most advantageous system. This consequence seemed to be the more difficult to explain, since the settlers, who all belonged to the same European race, had the same habits, the same civilization, the same laws, and their shades of difference were extremely slight. Time, however, continued to advance, and the Anglo-Americans, spreading beyond the coasts of the Atlantic Ocean, penetrated farther and farther into the solitudes of the West. They met with a new soil and an unwonted climate. The obstacles which opposed them were of the most various character. Their races intermingled. The inhabitants of the South went up towards the North, those of the North descended to the South. But in the midst of all these causes, the same result occurred at every step, and in general, the colonies in which there were no slaves became more populous and more rich than those in which slavery flourished. The more progress was made, the more it was shown that slavery, which is so cruel to the slave, is prejudicial to the master. But this truth was most satisfactorily demonstrated when civilization reached the banks of the Ohio. The stream, which the Indians had distinguished by the name of Ohio, or Beautiful River, waters one of the most magnificent valleys that has ever been made the abode of man. Undulating lands extend upon both shores of the Ohio, whose soil affords inexhaustible treasures to the laborer. On either bank the air is wholesome and the climate mild, and each of them forms the extreme frontier of a vast state. That which follows the numerous windings of the Ohio upon the left is called Kentucky, that upon the right bears the name of the river. These two states only differ in a single respect. Kentucky has admitted slavery, but the state of Ohio has prohibited the existence of slaves within its borders. Author's note: not only is slavery prohibited in Ohio, but no free Negroes are allowed to enter the territory of that state or to hold property in it. See the statutes of Ohio. Thus, the traveler who floats down the current of the Ohio to the spot where that river falls into the Mississippi may be said to sail between liberty and servitude. and a transient inspection of the surrounding objects will convince him as to which of the two is most favorable to mankind. Upon the left bank of the stream, the population is rare. From time to time, one descries a troop of slaves loitering in the half-desert fields. The primeval forest recurs at every turn. Society seems to be asleep, man to be idle, and nature alone offers a scene of activity and of life. From the right bank, on the contrary, a confused hum is heard which proclaims the presence of industry. The fields are covered with abundant harvests. The elegance of the dwellings announces the taste and activity of the laborer, and man appears to be in the enjoyment of that wealth and contentment which is the reward of labor. Author's note: the activity of Ohio is not confined to individuals, but the undertakings of the state are surprisingly great. A canal has been established between Lake Erie and the Ohio, by means of which the valley of the Mississippi communicates with the River of the North, and the European commodities which arrive at New York may be forwarded by water to New Orleans across 500 leagues of continent. The state of Kentucky was founded in 1775, the state of Ohio only 12 years later. But 12 years are more in America than half a century in Europe, and at the present day the population of Ohio exceeds that of Kentucky by 250,000 souls. Author's note: the exact numbers given by the census of 1830 were Kentucky 688,844, Ohio 937,679. These opposite consequences of slavery and freedom may readily be understood, and they suffice to explain many of the differences which we remark between the civilization of antiquity and that of our own time. Upon the left bank of the Ohio, labor is confounded with the idea of slavery. Upon the right bank, it is identified with that of prosperity and improvement. On the one side, it is degraded. On the other, it is honored. On the former territory, no white laborers can be found, for they would be afraid of assimilating themselves to the Negroes. On the latter, no one is idle, for the white population extends its activity and its intelligence to every kind of employment. Thus, the men whose task it is to cultivate the rich soil of Kentucky are ignorant and lukewarm, whilst those who are active and enlightened either do nothing or pass over into the state of Ohio, where they may work without dishonor. It is true that in Kentucky the planters are not obliged to pay wages to the slaves whom they employ, but they derive small profits from their labor, whilst the wages paid to free workmen would be returned with interest in the value of their services. The free workman is paid, but he does his work quicker than the slave, and rapidity of execution is one of the great elements of economy. The white sells his services, but they are only purchased at the times at which they may be useful. The black can claim no remuneration for his toil, but the expense of his maintenance is perpetual. He must be supported in his old age as well as in the prime of manhood, in his profitless infancy as well as in the productive years of youth. Payment must equally be made in order to obtain the services of either class of men. The free workman receives his wages in money, the slave in education, in food, in care, and in clothing. The money which a master spends in the maintenance of his slaves goes gradually and in detail, so that it is scarcely perceived. The salary of the free workman is paid in a round sum, which appears only to enrich the individual who receives it. But in the end, the slave has cost more than the free servant, and his labor is less productive. Author's note: independently of these causes, which, wherever free workmen abound, render their labor more productive and more economical than that of slaves, another cause may be pointed out which is peculiar to the United States. The sugar cane has hitherto been cultivated with success only upon the banks of the Mississippi, near the mouth of that river in the Gulf of Mexico. In Louisiana, the cultivation of the sugar cane is exceedingly lucrative, and nowhere does a laborer earn so much by his work, and as there is always a certain relation between the cost of production and the value of the produce, the price of slaves is very high in Louisiana. But Louisiana is one of the Confederated States, and slaves may be carried thither from all parts of the Union. The price given for slaves in New Orleans consequently raises the value of slaves in all other markets. The consequence of this is that in the countries where the land is less productive, the cost of slave labor is still very considerable, which gives an additional advantage to the competition of free labor. The influence of slavery extends still further. It affects the character of the master and imparts a peculiar tendency to his ideas and his tastes. Upon both banks of the Ohio, the character of the inhabitants is enterprising and energetic, but this vigor is very differently exercised in the two states. The white inhabitant of Ohio, who is obliged to subsist by his own exertions, regards temporal prosperity as the principal aim of his existence, and as the country which he occupies presents inexhaustible resources to his industry and ever-varying lures to his activity, his acquisitive ardor surpasses the ordinary limits of human cupidity. He is tormented by the desire of wealth, and he boldly enters upon every path which fortune opens to him. He becomes a sailor, a pioneer, an artisan, or a laborer with the same indifference, and he supports, with equal constancy, the fatigues and the dangers incidental to these various professions. The resources of his intelligence are astonishing, and his avidity in the pursuit of gain amounts to a species of heroism. But the Kentuckian scorns not only labor, but all the undertakings which labor promotes. As he lives in an idle independence, his tastes are those of an idle man. Money loses a portion of its value in his eyes. He covets wealth much less than pleasure and excitement. And the energy which his neighbor devotes to gain turns with him to a passionate love of field sports and military exercises. He delights in violent bodily exertion. He is familiar with the use of arms and is accustomed from a very early age to expose his life in single combat. Thus, slavery not only prevents the whites from becoming opulent, but even from desiring to become so. As the same causes have been continually producing opposite effects for the last two centuries in the British colonies of North America, they have established a very striking difference between the commercial capacity of the inhabitants of the South and those of the North. At the present day, it is only the northern states which are in possession of shipping, manufactures, railroads, and canals. The difference is perceptible not only in comparing the North with the South, but in comparing the several southern states. Almost all the individuals who carry on commercial operations or who endeavor to turn slave labor to account in the most southern districts of the Union have emigrated from the North. The natives of the northern states are constantly spreading over that portion of the American territory where they have less to fear from competition. They discover resources there which escaped the notice of the inhabitants, and as they comply with the system which they do not approve, they succeed in turning it to better advantage than those who first found it and who still maintain it. Were I inclined to continue this parallel, I could easily prove that almost all the differences which may be remarked between the characters of the Americans in the southern and in the northern states have originated in slavery. But this would divert me from my subject, and my present intention is not to point out all the consequences of servitude, but those effects which it has produced upon the prosperity of the countries which have admitted it. The influence of slavery upon the production of wealth must have been very imperfectly known in antiquity, as slavery then obtained throughout the civilized world, and the nations which were unacquainted with it were barbarous. And indeed Christianity only abolished slavery by advocating the claims of the slave. At the present time it may be attacked in the name of the master, and upon this point, interest is reconciled with morality. As these truths became apparent in the United States, slavery receded before the progress of experience. Servitude had begun in the South, and had thence spread towards the North. But it now retires again. Freedom, which started from the North, now descends uninterruptedly towards the South. Amongst the great states, Pennsylvania now constitutes the extreme limit of slavery to the North, but even within those limits the slave system is shaken. Maryland, which is immediately below Pennsylvania, is preparing for its abolition. And Virginia, which comes next to Maryland, is already discussing its utility and its dangers. Author's note: a peculiar reason contributes to detach the two last mentioned states from the cause of slavery. The former wealth of this part of the Union was principally derived from the cultivation of tobacco. This cultivation is specially carried on by slaves. But within the last few years, the market price of tobacco has diminished, whilst the value of the slaves remains the same. Thus, the ratio between the cost of production and the value of the produce is changed. The natives of Maryland and Virginia are therefore more disposed than they were 30 years ago to give up slave labor and the cultivation of tobacco, or to give up slavery and tobacco at the same time. No great change takes place in human institutions without involving amongst its causes the law of inheritance. When the law of primogeniture obtained in the South, each family was represented by a wealthy individual who was neither compelled nor induced to labor. And he was surrounded, as by parasitic plants, by the other members of his family who were then excluded by law from sharing the common inheritance, and who led the same kind of life as himself. The very same thing then occurred in all the families of the South, as still happens in the wealthy families of some countries in Europe, namely, that the younger sons remain in the same state of idleness as their elder brother, without being as rich as he is. This identical result seems to be produced in Europe and in America by wholly analogous causes. In the South of the United States, the whole race of whites formed an aristocratic body, which was headed by a certain number of privileged individuals whose wealth was permanent and whose leisure was hereditary. These leaders of the American nobility kept alive the traditional prejudices of the white race in the body of which they were the representatives and maintained the honor of inactive life. This aristocracy contained many who were poor, but none who would work. Its members preferred want to labor. Consequently, no competition was set on foot against Negro laborers and slaves, and whatever opinion might be entertained as to the utility of their efforts, it was indispensable to employ them, since there was no one else to work. No sooner was the law of primogeniture abolished than fortunes began to diminish, and all the families of the country were simultaneously reduced to a state in which labor became necessary to produce the means of subsistence. Several of them have since entirely disappeared, and all of them learned to look forward to the time at which it would be necessary for everyone to provide for his own wants. Wealthy individuals are still to be met with, but they no longer constitute a compact and hereditary body, nor have they been able to adopt a line of conduct in which they could persevere and which they could infuse into all ranks of society. The prejudice which stigmatized labor was in the first place abandoned by common consent. The number of needy men was increased, and the needy were allowed to gain a laborious subsistence without blushing for their exertions. Thus, one of the most immediate consequences of the partible quality of estates has been to create a class of free laborers. As soon as a competition was set on foot between the free laborer and the slave, the inferiority of the latter became manifest, and slavery was attacked in its fundamental principle, which is the interest of the master. As slavery recedes, the black population follows its retrograde course and returns with it towards those tropical regions from which it originally came. However singular this fact may at first appear to be, it may readily be explained. Although the Americans abolish the principle of slavery, they do not set their slaves free. To illustrate this remark, I will quote the example of the state of New York. In 1788,